Good morning again. We're going to get started. Our first presentation this morning is by Tony DeBora, an expanded game theoretic model of a pitcher-batter confrontation in baseball. Please welcome Tony DeBora.
Thank you and good morning. The work I'm going to describe, it's really a work in progress. Talking about applying a well-known branch of mathematics called game theory to the batter-pitcher confrontation. The other day someone said, oh, batter-pitcher confrontation, you're going to be talking about brawls? No, I'm not going to be talking about literal confrontations, just the matchups between batters and pitchers. Could you turn down the sound a little bit? I'm getting a little bit of an echo up here. Thank you. What I'm going to do first is describe the problem, a little bit of the history, how I am contributing to this string of work over the last few years. I'm going to get into a little bit of detail about a couple of the counts, and then I'm going to give an example of a well-pitched game, in fact, a perfect game from 2012, and then give some conclusions and future work. Since literally the 1970s, mathematicians have been studying ways to model the batter-pitcher confrontation in baseball in a baseball game as a classic two-person zero-sum game in game theory. And I'll show what that means to those of you who aren't real familiar with game theory. So in the original work, which is from sometime in the 70s, the original very simplistic model is that given a ball strike count, the batter determines a priori, even by flipping a coin or whatever means, whether to swing or take for a pitch, and the pitcher determines a priori whether they're going to throw a ball or a strike. Obviously, that's not a realistic model. No one intends it to be a realistic model. But what we want to do is extract from this model some knowledge, some information that in the future could be useful in reality. So the very simple model that was described in the 70s is that if the pitcher determines a priori that they're going to throw a strike, and the batter decides a priori that they're going to swing, the outcome is a hit, whatever that means. That's all the author had. And if the batter takes, then it's a strike. Likewise, if the pitcher a priori decides to throw a ball and the batter swings, it's a strike. So in this simple model, the batter does not hit a ball. And if the batter takes a ball, then the outcome, of course, is a ball. This I just put up to show how one can think of an at-bat as sort of as a tree with as a function of count with a whole lot of different outcomes. And incidentally, that's one of the reasons why I think that each at-bat is very interesting, because there are so many different possible outcomes and strategies as a basis of each point in that at-bat. I prefer to think of an at-bat in sort of this lattice structure, starting over here with a 0-0 count, and then it could be a strike, a ball, or the ball could be put into play, and so on. The pitcher, of course, wants to be up in this region of the lattice, 0-2, 1-2, 2-2, and the batter wants to be down in this region, which intuitively is advantageous to the batter. And then if the ball is not put into play, then the outcome is a walk or a strikeout. For the purpose of this study, by the way, I'm not making a distinction between a swinging strike with less than two outs and a foul ball with less than two strikes and a foul ball with less than two strikes. In other words, if the count is 2-2, in this study, it doesn't matter if it was achieved because the batter fouled off two balls, or whether those strikes were called strikes or swinging strikes. But there is I'm giving a reference here to a study that suggests that a batter's ultimate performance at bat is improved as he's hit foul balls instead of swinging and missing. So in 1981, I was given this simple model, this paper, as a senior to look at as a senior project when I was in college. And so what I did at that point was I extended the model so that if the batter swings at a strike, he gets a hit with a certain probability that's fixed. And if he swings at a ball, then he gets a hit with a presumably lower probability, C sub B. One of the things that came out of even that simple model, which was actually kind of fascinating to me, is that over all counts and for all realistic probabilities of the batter making contact with strikes and balls, the optimal strategy for a pitcher to minimize the expected number of hits and walks is to throw a strike about two-thirds of the time. That seems to be a golden ratio, even in this simple model, and it will carry through, as you'll see, as we work through. So today what I'm going to show are my newest contributions, most recent contributions to this model, trying to make it more realistic. So first of all, and there are four different areas of contributions. Instead of just using a generic hit, I'm using weighted on base average. Everybody has their favorite statistic, but I kind of bought into this. The model doesn't really depend on it, but it seems to be a sensible figure to use. And it takes into account the value over many games of outcomes of a batter's plate appearance. And it applies a weight, which really has to do with run production. So if you go right down to home runs, an average home run in 2013, and this doesn't change very much, an average home run is worth about two runs, for instance. An unintentional walk or hit by pitch, they're worth about three-quarters of a run. A single's worth a little more than that. Why? Because you have a greater chance of hitting another runner in, bringing in another run, reaching base on errors, doubles, triples, and home runs divided by plate appearances. For 2013, the major league average for weighted on base average was 314. And then there's just some support, sort of an elegant description in support of weighted on base average, because just arguing about how other statistics don't capture the fact that not all hits are created equal. Or slugging percentage, for instance, gives a weight to hits, but not very accurately. For instance, is a double really worth twice as much as a single? And it's not, and so forth. So using weighted on base average is kind of the payoff. Number two is that I expanded the model to have the batter make contact with a thrown strike with a probability that's a function of the count, CK for strike, IJ, where that I and J is the count. And similarly, making contact with a thrown ball with the probability CB sub IJ as a function of the count, not just a fixed probability. Thirdly, taking fouls into account. So hitting a thrown strike foul with a probability that's a function of the count, and similarly a ball with a probability that's a function of the count. Now we can track those things with pitch FX and so forth. The fourth one, which might be surprising to some of you, is taking into account umpire mistakes. And here, the umpire mistakenly calls a strike as a ball with probability mistake on a strike as a function of the count, and mistakenly calling a thrown ball as a strike with mistake on a ball, IJ, as a function of the count. And I think I talk about this a little later. In some cases, previous studies have shown that this number can be significant enough to impact studies such as mine. So we'll talk about that a little bit. There are several related results in recent years. One is when a pitcher meets a hitter, came out in 2010 online, and it's looking more at pitch selection. I'm not looking at pitch selection, I'm looking at simply balls and strikes. And then there was another study by Craig Glazer, also in 2010 online, and it focuses on the 3-2 count. And you can see some of the statistics for 2009, the number of balls that were swung at, out of how many they were thrown, that percentage, out of the percentages, as well as strikes and swings and so forth. Craig argues that batters are too aggressive with 3-2 counts, and I think this is important in my study also. The penalty of not swinging at a strike is not as great as the opportunity cost of swinging at a ball. Ball fours, walks are very valuable. So guys that go up hacking at bad pitches are really hurting themselves. The other thing that he pointed out, using the online databases, is that umpires mistakenly call nearly 40% of strikes as balls on a 3-2 count. So that he calls them the benevolent umpire, benevolent towards the hitter. And the best explanation I've seen of this is that hitters with a 3-2 count, hitters do a pretty good job of either putting a ball into play or hitting an obvious strike, hitting it foul. You've all seen, you know, it's fairly predictable that I think about 80% of balls on a 3-2 count are hit foul, the first pitch on a 3-2 count. So the obvious strikes are fouled off or taken care of by the hitter. The obvious balls are called ball four. And so what's left there are a lot of borderline strikes that the umpires are giving the benefit of the doubt to the hitter on. So let's look in my expanded model at the 3-2 count. And there are four possible outcomes, kind of in line with that matrix that I showed earlier. The pitcher can throw a strike and the batter takes. The outcome should be a strikeout, but if the umpire makes a missed call, it's a walk. If the pitcher throws a ball and the batter takes, similarly, it could be a walk or it could be a strikeout. It can also be a hit by pitch, so I've included that in the model. If the pitcher throws a strike and the batter swings, it's either hits it or he misses it, so it's either strikeout or contact. And if the pitcher throws a ball and the batter swings, likewise, it's either a strikeout or contact. Now, for this study, with two strikes, I'm considering a foul ball to simply be a do-over. Not a great assumption, but that's what I'm doing. If we extend that lattice to include states where you have two strikes and then one foul, two strikes and two fouls, and so forth, you can capture more realistically foul balls, but it really just complicates the model, so I didn't want to do that for now. So contact possible outcomes are a foul ball, which is equivalent to a strike with less than two strikes, and then a do-over with two strikes. It's an outcome of a contact could be a hit, it could be reaching base on error, it can be an out, or it can be fielder's choice. So here's the payoff matrix, and I'm going to go through each one of these quickly. It's early in the morning, so we're not going to do a heck of a lot of math, but at least you'll get the idea. And what we want to do is figure out, these are probabilities, so the batter wants to figure out with a 3-2 count, what percentage of the time should I be swinging and what percentage of the time should I be taking, likewise the pitcher wants to figure out what percentage of the time should I be throwing a strike and what percentage of the time should I be throwing a ball. So the first situation is that the pitcher throws a strike and the batter takes. So that's very straightforward. Either it's going to be a strikeout or a walk, depending on the umpire's call. So if the umpire gets it right, then this payoff value is the umpire getting it right, and then if he gets it right, the batter strikes out and receives a payoff of negative weighted on base, the lost opportunity cost, so negative weighted on base average. And if the umpire makes a mistake and calls it a ball, then the batter walks, and so that's the payoff for that. And what I'm doing is I'm subtracting so that things work out right. I'm normalizing everything by subtracting the weighted on-base average, just so the numbers make sense. The second situation in the matrix is the pitcher throws a ball and the batter takes. Similar to the first one, can be a walk, can still be a strikeout if the umpire makes a mistake, or it can be a hit by pitch. So here's the probability of being hit by pitch. Here's the probability of the umpire making a mistake, which leads to a strikeout, which costs the batter. And here's the probability of the batter walking. So pretty simple probability theory. The third situation, the pitcher throws a strike and the batter swings. And so you can see, likewise, you get there's contact or there's a swing and miss. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through the fourth one. But you can see this leads to a payoff matrix for the pitcher and for the batter. So for the pitcher, he's in worse shape if he throws a ball and the batter takes, for instance. So you can see that. So then we can figure out what's called a Nash equilibrium point or an optimal strategy where it makes no where the pitcher determines the optimal probability or percentage that they should throw a strike, and the batter determines the optimal probability that they should swing. And so for a 3-2 count, not surprisingly, the pitcher should be throwing a strike over 90% of the time, and likewise, the batter should be swinging away about 75% of the time. This is consistent with the other talk that I mentioned earlier. So what's the intuition behind this? The pitcher is almost always trying to throw a strike since the penalty for a walk is pretty large. And even if the batter makes contact, we have to remember that the odds are still in the pitcher's favor. So the pitcher's still in the catbird seat. And then on top of that, the pitcher still is also working against the umpire, which is benevolent to the hitter. And the batter is mostly swinging to defend against a strikeout, but the reward of a walk is worth taking pitches on occasion. And then I have some. These really don't match up very well with what happened in 2008. In some cases, they sort of do. Basically, more balls in play than one would expect from the theory, and a lot more walks than one would expect. So that's something that I want to dig into a little more. So essentially, pitchers have an uphill battle on a 3-2 count. They're under pressure to throw a strike to avoid walking, and they don't have total control over throwing a strike anyway, and so forth. Then we can extend this to other counts. I'm going to have to push through here because of time. So you can see this becomes recursive because, for instance, with a 0-0 count, if the pitcher throws a strike and the batter takes, then it's either going to be 0-1 or 1-0. And then essentially the payoff becomes a function of the payoff for 0-1 or the payoff of 1-0. So you can see just the math in here. So we'll get to the good part, and you can see the payoff matrix. We'll get to the good part here. So for a 0-0 count, this is really surprising. It's saying that a pitcher really doesn't have to throw that many strikes early on. And because the batter's strategy is really to come out swinging, so it's good. Essentially, the pitcher has to throw enough strikes to keep the batter swinging, but also trying to get them to chase some bad pitches. And you can see optimal strategies for each count, for the pitcher and for the batter. And I've highlighted some things that are a little bit surprising, like this one. Well, this really isn't surprising on a 3-0 count. Either surprising or things that match our intuition, I guess. So I also put the ideal outcomes after the batter's swung or taken and the pitcher's thrown a strike or a ball. This says that, for instance, on an 0-0 count, ultimately, about 19%, say 20% of the balls should be put into play. 53% should be either a strike, swinging strike or foul. 28% and 28% should be a ball, and so forth. So in the ideal case, which you can see isn't realistic, about 70% of the balls should be put into play. About 30% of all at-bats should end up in a strikeout, which they don't. And also, less than 1% should be a walk. So The optimal strategy, not surprising at all, is that the pitcher should really work hard to avoid walks. Here's an example of a well-pitched game, Felix Hernandez's perfect game from August 15th, 2012. And you can see for each count the number of strikes, what the theory says is optimal, the number of balls, what the theory says is optimal, and in play, what the theory says is optimal. So, of course, there were 27 at-bats, and you can go on down the line, and you can see how closely Felix Hernandez adhered to the optimal strategy, resulting in about 68% strikes. By the way, this golden ratio of 2-to-1 strikes to balls, that's assuming all of the parameters today, the velocity at which pitchers can pitch, or the effectiveness of pitchers and hitters. For instance, if somebody came along and could, to be ridiculous, could throw a 200-mile-an-hour fastball that nobody could touch, then they wouldn't have to worry about throwing 2/3 strikes. They could throw a strike every time, and nobody would be able to hit it. And there's the strike zone plot from brooksbaseball.net. And you can see, let's see, if there's a called strike outside the zone, there are a few. And a few balls inside the zone. So you can see that even in this game, there were some missed calls. One of the last things I'll leave in the remaining time I'll leave you with is that I was talking to a hitting instructor in one of the major league organizations, and he observed that since about 50% of all at-bats reach two strikes, which is true, and that's a disadvantage to the batter, then his instructions to batters are simply avoid two strikes. So that sounds like a good philosophy, except that in the game theory model, there's a fallacy there. And the fallacy is that if your opponent figures out that you're trying to avoid two strikes at all costs, then when they have one strike on you, they probably don't have to work as hard to throw a strike because they know you're going to be busy trying to hack away to avoid two strikes. So that's where game theory plays into this. To conclude, I would like to point out some questions, and hopefully you have other questions, because this is really a work in progress. Number one is continuing to validate the model and using up-to-date statistics and really harvesting as much as we can from the existing databases to refine this model. Secondly is to see if it's feasible to incorporate the best of both worlds, all of the work on pitch selection and all the work on ball strike or even inside, outside, high and low. Third is to really use individual statistics and see how sensitive this model is depending on the statistics of an individual pitcher or an individual hitter. Also, there's something I think is an interesting question in game theory in general, and that is, how do you know when a pitcher, for instance, is changing his strategy or a batter is changing his strategy? Because that would mean, for instance, if you figure out that a pitcher suddenly decides to throw all strikes, at what point do you change your strategy as a hitter or vice versa? And secondly, since of course this is not realistic because pitchers can't control completely whether they throw a strike or a ball, and hitters are getting information after the pitch is thrown. So I believe that this is a way ultimately to quantify how much information the hitter is getting as soon as the pitch is thrown or during the windup, combined with a tendency or an inclination to swing or take, which we know in reality, a batter's action is a combination of anticipating a pitch and reacting to what happens during the windup and after the release point. So hopefully this has given you some food for thought, and I think we have time for a couple of questions. Yes, sir.
Does this game theory, this one-on-one game, not have to worry about whether or not there's a man on base, how many outs there are, before that, or as that is taking place,
yeah.
Worry about defensive shifting and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, excellent question. Does this worry about men on base, number of outs, defensive shifts, and so forth? At this point, it does not. But I believe that this model could be refined, and that would be very interesting, like a hit-and-run situation or thing. I don't know. Different outs, how that impacts, and how sensitive strategies should be to that. Maybe they're, you know, doing a sensitivity analysis, I think, would be very interesting. Thank you.
Yes.
So, two questions. One, are you using the rule of strike zone to determine whether a ball is incorrectly called a ball instead of a ball strike? Because I know umpires don't necessarily follow the rule of strike zone. They can be consistent in how they call balls and strikes, just
yeah.
Not match up with the rule of strike zone.
Yeah, that's a good question because, and players can make those adjustments during the game, of course. I'm just using the information from PitchFX.
I think Brooks Baseball is
okay.
Second comment is, so the model as presented expects that a pitcher can throw a strike on his hands.
Of course.
So, is there any studies just how accurate that assumption is? I'm curious. Does anybody know if he can throw 90%?
Yeah, I don't know, but did I hear someone else say yes? No? I don't know. That would be awesome. You know, I've talked informally to pitchers, but it's a little touchy to say, hey, you know, how good are you at really throwing a strike when you want to? Most pitchers would probably say, oh, I'm really good at it. I don't know. All right, great. Thank you very much.
Great job.
Thank you.